The notes that you have today give you a detailed study of chapter 28, and it is important to keep in mind some of the points that are raised in that lesson last week, because the key points from our study of chapter 28 will guide us or will be helpful to us as we continue with chapters 29 and 30. Actually, chapters 29, 30 and 31 all hang together as a single speech. But because of the importance of chapter 31, we would need to devote an entire lesson to it. And that, God willing, would be next Lord's Day. So what are the key points? There are basically four that we carry forward from chapter 28. Chapter 28 went into great depth to describe the skills, the ingenuity, the daring, the courage, the persistence of human beings, not only in searching for treasure below the earth, but also in what might be called the softer skills of agriculture and animal husbandry. And yet, for all that skill, knowledge, and practical wisdom, man is still in dire need of true wisdom, which is why human beings then, through the ages and now, are still searching for wisdom, and wisdom is perhaps prized, even in our very carnal times, is prized more than material wealth. The second point that was brought across clearly in chapter 28 is that however much you try, you can never explain God to human beings. No amount of scientific or technological advance can explain God to man. Nor can science or human understanding shed any light on the way God so marvelously and efficiently runs the whole world. It is one thing to create such a marvelous world. It is another thing to run it so consistently and so predictably for generations or thousands of years to come. Therefore, this is leading us via irresistible logic to just a single conclusion. Granted, man is in need of wisdom, true wisdom. Man has been searching for wisdom for countless ages. Look high, look low, look below the earth, look below the seas, look to the heavens, and you won't find it. The conclusion to which we are driven is a very obvious one, but it took all this striving to come to the basic point, which is that somehow, if you can find God, you will find wisdom, because obviously without wisdom God could not have created this marvelous world. Without wisdom God could not have sustained it and caused it to operate the very smooth and predictable way that we observe around us. How do we find God? It's easier said than done, but God is not there so that we can go there in search of Him. God, in a sense, is everywhere. And in a sense, as we know from the New Testament perspective, God is actually within us by the Holy Spirit. So we don't go searching for God in the literal sense of searching for an individual fellow human being who is at a definite place at a different time. That search cannot be applied literally to our search for God. Searching for God, therefore, must mean cultivating a special kind of relationship with God. Not just a relationship in name, like for example being baptized and confessing Jesus as Lord and Savior. Whether you mean it or not, for formality's sake, you have taken the baptism, oath, you are baptized. It is not that kind of relationship which is formal. The formality is important, but that's not the heart of it. The heart of it is the intimacy of the relationship. And to cultivate that kind of relationship, that level of intimacy, requires as a prerequisite a very deep reverence, a very deep respect for the name and for the attributes of God, as well as the resolution to depart from every conceivable evil way. The two must go together. You cannot say you reverence God and continue to indulge in carnal or sinful habits. So that is how we search and find God. We build an intimate relationship with Him in this manner. Thus, chapter 28 ends with the conclusion, which reinforces the fourth point about finding God. Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. What is this fear of the Lord? Is it fear in the literal sense? Is it just reverence in the literal sense? Here's an example that will help to crystallize our thoughts. As an adult, and with a family of my own, I still would not knowingly do or practice anything that my parents would not approve of. Why? Not because I fear them in the sense that if I disobey them or evoke their wrath, they might cut me off financially. In fact, it's the other way around. Financially, I am independent and they are dependent on me. Is it because of fear of corporal punishment? Certainly not. There is no way they have the physical strength to discipline me by way of corporal punishment. So it is not the literal fear that drives me to refrain from doing or saying anything that I know they would disapprove of. It is, on the other hand, purely and simply a respect for them as my parents. When it comes to reverence for God, there must be the same element of respect. But in addition, there is also, where God is concerned, there must also be a literal fear, a fear of the consequences of going against Him. Where God is concerned, therefore, the reverence for God must include both of these elements: a deep respect for Him, which we can easily understand from human relationships, and also a literal fear of God. The fear of God acts as a very necessary kind of restraint or a brake upon our sinful tendencies. So keep this in mind. We notice that there are three terms in chapter 28, and in fact throughout this whole book of Job, that keep recurring. And last week we spent a fair amount of time discussing the distinctions between these three terms. What are these three terms? Knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. I won't repeat the details that I gave last week, except to summarize it in the following way. Knowledge, fairly easy to understand, is the accumulation of a body of information about a particular subject or a topic. And the opposite of it is ignorance. So knowledge can be understood easily by considering its opposite twin, which is ignorance. What about wisdom? Wisdom describes a deep insight into a particular subject or topic, or else a particular kind of skill or expertise. If you are called by a telemarketer and made an irresistible offer, the ability to see through the offer and detect the hidden catch is an instance of wisdom. What about understanding? Understanding refers to the skill of working out at any given point in time the best course of action to take. So you can associate wisdom with insight and understanding with decision-making skill. It's an easy way to remember it. And I summed up this section by giving this catchphrase summary: knowledge is the fuel that feeds both wisdom and understanding, but knowledge in and of itself cannot guarantee either wisdom or understanding. With that, we shall come to the study of chapters 29 and 31. As I mentioned, 29 through 31 really come together as a single speech. So chapter 29 is occupied with a single topic before the disaster came upon Job. Chapter 30 can be looked at as AD, after the disaster. And chapter 31 is a legal statement, what we would in modern legal terms call a deposition. At least in the American legal system, it would be called a deposition. In content, chapter 31 is the final defense of Job, because at the close of chapter 31, we find the statement, "Thus the words of Job are ended." And indeed, there is nothing more that we hear from Job to the end of the book. And even if he wanted to say anything to rebut the speeches of Elihu, which will follow from chapter 32 onwards, he had no opportunity, because as soon as Elihu had ended his speech in chapter 37, in chapter 38, God cuts in, and thereafter God monopolizes the whole conversation through the end of the book. So literally, as the text says, chapter 31 with chapter 31, the words of Job are indeed ended. Now chapter 29, before the disaster. I will select only particular verses for our consideration today. To start off, verses 2 and 4. "Oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when God preserved me, as I was in the days of my youth, when the secret of God was upon my tabernacle." Clearly, Job longs to be restored to his former estate in order that his community and his three friends in particular would appreciate the level to which he has fallen from his former glory, his former estate, and thereby they would come to have genuine sympathy for him. Once they understood, or they could understand, that this was the position that Job occupied in the sight of God and man, and overnight, literally, he is reduced to the dregs of society, they would at least recognize that perhaps no man had fallen like this through no fault of his own, and they would therefore have some kind of genuine sympathy for him. You can't blame Job for feeling this way. It is a very natural desire. Nobody likes to live under a cloud, particularly if you know you are innocent. It is a very natural and a very proper human desire to want to clear your name. So don't blame Job for wanting people to sympathize with him. He's basically not fishing for sympathy. He is seeking approval or understanding, at the very least, from his community. Please remember that much as we may pride ourselves on being self-sufficient, introverted, in control of my life, God has so made man and woman that we each require the support of the community, whether it be our circle of relatives and friends, whether it be our brothers and sisters in Christ. Each of us requires the support of the community in order to survive. And the way to see it is, if you are put into solitary confinement in prison, how long would you last? It would not be long before the average human being would have a mental breakdown. So the support of the community is vital for the mental and emotional health of any human being. So don't blame Job for wanting the approval of society, the sympathy of society, to be given back to him. Also remember that the three friends had branded Job as an impatient person, impatient with God. And Job wanted them in particular to realize that his lamentation stretched out over these 30 chapters, a pretty long lamentation, was in his case fully justified because of the depth and the severity, the extent of the suffering to which he had been subjected. So in the verses of that constitute chapter 29, we find a great deal of emphasis on the good works that Job had done. He is not blowing his trumpet, he is actually summarizing, condensing his defense. And bear in mind, 29, 30 and 31 hang together. So whatever we read or study in chapters 29 and 30 must be seen in the light of a preparation for the all-important final defense in chapter 31. Do not consider chapter 29 or chapter 30 in isolation. You will not understand or appreciate it, and you will not appreciate chapter 31 if you take this piecemeal approach. So the emphasis in chapter 29 on the good works is not to curry favor, is not to boast, but it is with a very particular objective in mind, preparing for the final defense. Here is my affidavit testifying to the good I have done. At least, at the very least, this record will serve as a mitigating consideration when the final verdict is delivered by the great judge. I draw your attention to two specific phrases which need explanation. In verse 2, you will see the phrase, "days of my youth," and also the phrase, "secret of God." It is always a difficult task for any translator to choose the right word or expression in a different language, and it was no different to the problem faced by the KJV translators. So they stuck as far as possible to their principle of a formal equivalent, which would sometimes result in tricky English constructions. But then it was also one of their principles that the task of explanation is not that of the translator, is that of the teacher or the preacher. So they kept to that, these two guiding principles. So as far as they were concerned, the word youth in the phrase "days of my youth" correctly represented the Hebrew root word koreth. However, if you look at the lexicon, koreth literally refers to the crop that is gathered at harvest time. So you cannot apply that literal meaning here. The context will not allow it. Koreth is not the fruit gathered at harvest time. But what is the underlying sentiment? The underlying sentiment is not that of a young man, but rather, if you consider when the fruit is gathered, is the fruit gathered in springtime? No way, that's when the planting is done. It is gathered only at a specific time when the plants have ripened and they are ready. That is the correct season, the season of harvesting. Therefore, that concept applied in this situation, days of my youth, must refer to that period of time when a human being has the fullness of mental and physical vigor and strength. So understand the phrase days of my youth in this sense, that Job is referring to that period of life when he still was at the maximum of his intellectual and bodily vigor and strength. Secret of God. The term secret corresponds to the Hebrew root word sod, which refers to a closely knit council or assembly. Again, that is a literal meaning, but it would not apply directly here. So again, we have to look at what is the underlying sentiment. When you have a closely knit fellowship of people with God at the center, that expression itself tells you what it's all about. It is pointing to the certain intimacy of relationship between the members, as well as between the members and the central figure, which is God. So therefore, this phrase, secret of God, though literally it refers to a closely knit council or assembly, is a metaphor that points to intimacy of fellowship with God. You can appreciate from these two examples how important it is not just to have a lexicon at hand, but equally important to be able to be guided by the context in deciding what is the actual meaning of a word or phrase. Without the context, looked at in isolation, a word can have a variety of meanings. So you cannot consider, particularly in Hebrew, you cannot consider individual words in isolation. I next draw your attention to a combination passage, verses 11, 12, 13, and then jump to verse 15 and on to 16 and 17. When the ear heard me, then it blessed me, and when the eye saw me, it gave witness to me, because I delivered the poor that cried and the fatherless, and him that had none to help him. The blessing of him that was ready to perish came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. 15. I was eyes to the blind, and feet was I to the lame. I was a father to the poor, and the cause which I knew not I searched out. And I brake the jaws of the wicked, and plucked the spoil out of his teeth, somewhat like a latter-day Robin Hood. So this really, verses 11 through 15 and then through 13 and then 15 through 17, is a very quick review of the character of Job's life before the disaster struck. And what is the consistent feature in the verses that we have read? He's, again, bear in mind, he's not trumpeting his achievements, but if you look in detail at what he did, he delivered the poor, he was a protector to the fatherless, he was a helper to those that had no help, those that were in extremity came automatically to him, and because of his help, their hearts were turned to joy. Eyes to the blind, feet to the lame is not literally to be taken that way, but it refers to the way in which Job provided counsel, guidance, advice, plus the follow-through. It is one thing to give advice at a point in time, but most of us give advice to a friend or to someone in need, and then we leave matters as it is, and the person who is struggling is then left to struggle on his or her own. It takes an equal amount of patience and effort to do the follow-up. You give the advice and you continue to follow up. You continue to strengthen the person with encouragement and advice, with reproof if need be. So the whole process can be very long drawn out. It's not a simple matter of you come to me and like an oracle I dispense advice and that's it. The only difference being my advice is free, whereas if you go to a psychologist you pay through your nose. It is not that kind of help. Job is saying that he not only gave advice and guidance, he followed the person through until the problem was resolved. It is in that sense that we are to understand the expression, I was eyes to the blind and feet was I to the lame. And then he says, I was father to the poor, and the cause which I knew not I searched out. And he was actually a defender. He was judge, jury and executioner rolled into one, as is emphasized in verse 17. Break the jaws of the wicked, pluck the spoil out of his teeth. So the point of it is that consistently, not just a one-time effort in a blaze of enthusiasm, but consistently, that this was the pattern of Job's life before the disaster. Not only was he on intimate terms with God, which required purity of heart and mind, he was also one who consistently went about doing good. Does not that characteristic of Job remind us of someone else of whom this exact same description was applied, who went about doing good? None other than the Lord Jesus himself, Acts chapter 10, verse 38. Therefore, before the disaster, the life of Job, wholesome in relation to God and of practical and help to his fellow man without any consideration of self-interest. These two factors, the relationship with God and the relationship with one's fellow man, which involves a giving of oneself, a sacrificial giving of oneself, one's time, one's effort, both of these qualities come together to mark a truly godly person. In other words, the piety of Job was not a self-centered one. It's not, what do I mean by self-centered piety? It is the type of piety where, assuming you can even call it piety, the type of piety in which the person is only concerned about his or her relationship with God. Yes, that is absolutely vital. Without that relationship, nothing else works. But if it stops there, then it is, you are like living in a kind of spiritual vacuum, you and God alone. But the point is, God didn't create you alone on this planet and leave you completely alone. He created you as a person in a community. Therefore, you cannot be a full human being unless you are aware of your links to and obligations towards the community. It's required, therefore, that one's piety, if it is to be counted as true piety, that it involves both of these elements, pure in heart towards God and self-sacrificing in love and good works to one's fellow man. And against this background, we read the verse 14, which I have left out till now. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My judgment was as a robe and a diadem. By the way, the word diadem here corresponds to the Hebrew root word sanif. And sanif can be a diadem, but in the particular context here, it is more accurate to think of it as a headdress that is wound around the head, what we today would call a turban. And this is not peculiar to the time of Job alone, because we find that in the Levitical system, the high priest wore a mitre, a turban-like headdress. Example being Zechariah chapter 3 verse 5. And I said, let them set a fair that is pure mitre, mitre being sanith, upon his head, referring to Joshua the high priest. So they set a fair mitre upon his head and clothed him with garments. So I would read that diadem there as a turban, typical of the kind of turban used by the high priest, signifying that in his community, Job was respected as the great judge, the equivalent of what we would call chief justice today. And that raises an interesting legal set of terms for discussion. Justice and equity. We find these terms used interchangeably, but if you were to do a quick survey, 9 out of 10 people would probably not be able to define either justice or equity. So it is worth a little digression to ponder these two terms. What I propose to give you is my personal understanding of these two terms. You are at liberty to study the matter yourself. It is an interesting study. Justice, equity. How do we understand the distinction between the two? First, justice. Justice is the uniform and consistent application of the law of the land without regard to any personal considerations whatsoever and without being ever influenced by a bribe or coerced by a threat. Justice, the consistent and uniform application of the laws of the land without any fear or favor towards anybody. What about equity? Equity is a very interesting legal concept because it refers to mitigation of a judgment according to the law, mitigation of a judgment if it appears that in a given situation the law, if applied directly, would result in a very unnecessarily harsh judgment. At the same time, equity would kick in situations where the law of the land is found to have some kind of shortfall. It may be worded too generally to be applied to a given case. Best way is to give you an example. The judgment against a young offender for a fairly serious crime is a prison sentence. However, the defendant is a young person and he is a first-time offender. Is it proper, is it beneficial rather, let's look at it that way, is it really beneficial to that person to send him, young as he is, first-time offender, straight to jail to be in a community of rascals, hardcore convicts? Is it going to help this young person at all? The law says, for this crime, here is the punishment. For this crime, the sentence is 2 years of imprisonment. So there's no argument about it. There's no question of bending the rules. However, if the case goes to appeal, the appeal judge has the jurisdiction to rule whether considerations of equity should be applied to the case. And if the appeal judge decides that since this is a first-time offender and he is young, it is not going to help him in the long term to be thrown straight away into prison, and therefore the appeal judge commutes the sentence of 2 years imprisonment to a fine plus 500 hours, say, of community service. that action of the appeal judge would be an example of equity. So equity can be thought of as a mitigation of the rigor of the law, or else an addressing of a perceived shortfall in the way the law is crafted for a given variety of cases. The important consideration where equity is concerned is this: there will often, where equity is applied, there will often be instances where a ruling according to the law is in direct conflict with a ruling according to equity. Now, which one therefore has, which one should prevail? You can't have two interpretations of the same law applied to a given defendant. Either you apply the law like a ton of bricks thrown at a person, or while the law allows for that, equity says tone it down because there are justifiable reasons for doing so. It's either one or the other, two interpretations of the law. In situations where there is such a conflict between a ruling based on law and a ruling based on equity, under the English common law model, equity always prevails to this day. Therefore, justice must be administered, but with equity. Justice cannot, should not be applied blindly. The image that we often conjure up in our minds of justice is that of the statue of a lady carrying a sword, carrying a pair of scales in the other hand, and blindfolded. Yes, that does reflect one aspect of justice, not blind to the facts, but blind to personal influences. In other words, impartial. At the same time, that is not a complete picture because it leaves out equity. And there's no such simple statue that we can construct and say, oh, this is the twin of the lady who represents justice. There is no such model. But the two must go together. Justice must, should always be applied with equity. This legal digression is not because I enjoy going into these little topics, but because it sets the stage for chapter 31. Chapter 31 must be seen and read and understood in the context of a legal defense, because that's really what it amounts to. It's the final, the closing statement in the long defense that Job makes as to his own innocence. So this particular legal direction paves the way for that. Now we are at verses 18, 19 and 20 of chapter 29. Then I said, I shall die in my nest, and I shall multiply my days as the sand. My root was spread out by the waters, and the dew lay all night upon my branch. My glory was fresh in me, and my bow was renewed in my hand. First and foremost, this expression, as the sand, realize that it's a metaphor used often in the Old Testament to indicate an indefinite, a very, very large number. So what Job expresses here is his desire and expectation to live a good long life and finally die peacefully at home, surrounded by family and close friends. Is he being selfish, complacent, or indulgent in expressing that wish? Absolutely not. This desire to live a long and fruitful life and finally to die peacefully without any serious or painful illness, to die peacefully, not in a hospital, heaven forbid, but at home, surrounded by familiar faces, by your loved ones, This is not selfish on the part of Job, because it is a very natural desire of every human being, and certainly the desire also of every true believer. So don't blame Job for being self-centered or complacent or indulgent. He is expressing a very natural and even a proper desire. In verse 19, where he speaks of his root spread out by the waters, dew lying all night upon his branch, it carries the same idea that is reflected in the very first Psalm, Psalm 1 and verse 3, if you recall. And he, that is the godly man, shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water, that bringeth forth his fruit in his season. His leaf also shall not wither, and whatsoever he doeth shall prosper. It's the same idea. What is important is this: the image of a luxuriant tree and flowing water is a very striking image, maybe not to us because we see enough of it, but in the Near East, given the arid climate, such instances of luxuriant foliage and running water are a rarity. They are not the norm. Therefore, in the context, the imagery used by Job is a very striking one to describe how very productive and fruitful his life had been. Verse 20, my glory was fresh in me, my bow was renewed in my hand. It carries the idea of one whose strength and vigor was sustained despite the advancing years. The image of the bow refers to the archer. The bow was sustained, refers to the archer who keeps his bow constantly drawn, firing off arrow after arrow. And in order to do that, it presupposes on the part of the archer not only strength but stamina, because it does require considerable physical force to draw the bow, and to do it repeatedly, it requires both strength and stamina. So verse 20 carries the idea of continued, sustained vigor and strength. And such was Job, so he says. Now verses 21 through 25. Remember, verse chapter 29 has to do with Job in his prime before the disaster. Verse 21, unto me man gave ear and waited and kept silence at my counsel. After my words they spake not again, and my speech dropped upon them. And they waited for me as for the rain, and they opened their mouths wide as for the latter rain. If I laughed on them, they believed it not. Not that they believed what I was laughing at, but they did not accept what was proposed. We'll come to that. And the light of my countenance they cast not down. I chose out their way. I selected the decision for them, and sat chief, and dwelt as a king in the army, as one that comforteth the mourners. So great was the respect that Job enjoyed in his community, and so wise and penetrating his counsel, that as a rule, whenever he made a judgment or made a decision, no man ever ventured to dispute his words. The expression, my speech dropped upon them, that we read earlier, is paralleled by Deuteronomy chapter 32 verse 2, which chapter is of course the Song of Moses. There Moses says, using a very similar form of expression, my doctrine, my teaching shall drop as the rain, my speech shall distill as the dew, as the small rain upon the tender herb, and as the showers upon the grass. Thus, what we have just read, verse 23, is a beautiful rendition They waited for me as for the rain. They opened their mouths wide as for the latter rain. It's a beautiful expression highlighting the importance of Job to his community. Just as rain is vital for the germination of seeds and for the growth of all manner of vegetation, so too the counsel of Job was needful for the prosperity of his community. And that is perhaps the highest form of accolade any person can get. Not a medal, but the sheer power of his influence. When he opened his mouth and he spake, that settles the matter. Verse 24, if I laughed on them, they believed it not, and the light of my countenance they cast not down. This underscores what I've just said. You know, there are many measures of influence of a person, but perhaps one of the highest measures of influence is this, that a person can influence the decision of a council or an assembly not by an elaborate and eloquent speech, but by a mere gesture. A shake of the head means no, and that becomes the council's decision. A nod is a yes, and that immediately becomes the council's decision. The ability thus to influence the decision making of an assembly or a council with just a gesture without any elaborate speech is the highest measure of the power of the influence of a single human being. And that was the kind of influence that Job wielded in his community. You might wonder that a person who did so much good, who was so right with God, who was so strong that everyone from small to great leaned on him and counted upon his counsel and guidance, that such a person surely must be immune to the attacks of Satan. But as this book illustrates to us, as long as we are in this earthly life, no one can ever rest comfortably with the idea that, oh, I am, because of my antecedents, because of my track record, I am immune to the ploys of Satan. Because we are dealing with a supernatural enemy and one whose powers, literally speaking, without God surrounding us and supporting us, we are mincemeat for the satanic powers. It's a very sobering thought, and pastors and leaders in particular must take note of this. Your position in the church, your rank in the community of saints does not grant you immunity to satanic attacks. Now we are at chapter 30. After the disaster, we saw the beautiful picture in chapter 29. Now comes the shocker, chapter 30. It is really a lament by Job. But Job is not simply bemoaning the tragedy that has befallen him. He has a higher purpose in mind. In chapter 30, while he laments the fate that has come upon him, his objective is more noble than simply complaining. He wants to portray to God the sheer magnitude, the scope, the extent, the depth of the degradation of his life as a result of the barrage of afflictions that have been let loose upon him. And therefore, he is trying to underscore the claim that he has made in the earlier chapters, that all this that has happened to him is really not fair at all. And if he can win this argument that it is not fair, if God will agree that it is not fair, then the outcome is immediate. All of these afflictions will be removed and he will be restored to health and strength again. So that is his ultimate objective in this lament. He is not simply groaning and mourning and nagging and complaining because he enjoys or he has nothing else to do. He has a more sensible purpose in mind. There are three sections to this lament. And what is interesting is, it's easy to identify them because each section is preceded by the phrase "and now," or else by the phrase "but now." First section comprised of verses 1 through 8. Chapter 30, verse 1. "But now," that introduces this section, "but now they that are younger than I have me in derision, whose fathers I would have disdained," that is, considered unworthy, "to have sat with the dogs of my flock." Recall that in ancient society, dogs were indicative of the greatest contempt for a person. So what Job is saying is, these worthless fellows, whose fathers I wouldn't even have treated with the same consideration as I would the dogs that roam the streets, they are now mocking me and ridiculing me. Verse 2, "Yea, whereto might the strength of their hands profit me, in whom old age was perished? For want and famine they were solitary, fleeing into the wilderness in former time, desolate and waste, who cut up mallows by the bushes and juniper roots for their meat." This will be explained shortly. "They were driven forth among men, they cried after them as after the sea, to dwell in the cliffs of the valleys, in caves of the earth, and in the rocks. Among the bushes they brayed," that is, like animals, "under the nettles where no human being would go. They were so thick-skinned, they would find their shelter under the prickly nettles. They were gathered together. They were children of fools." Fools there is a very familiar expression, Nabalim, the singular being Nabal. And Nabal we associate with Abigail, and Abigail and Nabal we associate ultimately with King David. So Nabal is a worthless person. Nabalim is the plural form. They were children of fools. They were, if their fathers were worthless, they, the children, were less than worthless. Children of base men, they were viler than the earth. This terrible description is not an example of the perversity of Job's character. He is using it as a metaphor for the state that he is in. Basically, he is saying that these people are the lowest level of society in Job's day. They really were such people. They were the vagabonds. They were so rough and so crude in their ways that they were not allowed to live within the city, and as a result they had to make their dwellings in caves or else to live out in the open, sleep in the open outside the city gates. There were such people, and they were the lowest level of society in Job's day. And yet Job says these are the very people who are now making fun of me and laughing at me. This is a very graphic way of portraying how far Job has fallen from the state of grace. I mentioned to you verse 4 would be explained, "who cut up mallows by the bushes and juniper roots for their meat." The mallows referred to by Job in chapter 30 verse 4, mallows, is believed to be a particular type of plant known as the salt wort, W-O-R-T. And this plant is commonly found in semi-desert areas. It is consumed as food by the poorest of the poor. So again, it's a way of saying that the people who consume this kind of food, who are really at that lowest level of society, they have the audacity, Job says, to start mocking and ridiculing me. Therefore, it means that they have lost all their fear of me, that they are, with impunity, they can mock me in this manner. What are these juniper roots? Some commentators have taken the view that the reference juniper is actually to a plant known as a Spanish broom, which does thrive in the poor soil and arid climate of the Near East. The problem I have with that is this. The Spanish broom is known to be poisonous. All parts of this plant are poisonous if ingested. Therefore, I cannot believe that the reference is to, as these commentators claim, is to the Spanish broom, but it must be literally to the juniper that Job is referring to. And it makes sense in another way, because if you look at the juniper plant, it's a low straggling branch with spreading branches and very small leaves. The berries are edible, so there's food there, free food for the plucking. And also, because of its contour, its low spreading branches, it provides excellent shade. And if you remember, one of the great prophets of God who was on the run trying to get into the desert became exhausted on his journey and he took shelter. Where else would he take shelter but under this kind of tree, the juniper tree? Who was that prophet? None other than our old friend Elijah. 1 Kings 19 verse 5. And now I am there, song verses 9 through 15. The point here is this. When ridicule is turned into rhyme, then it signifies a level at which ridicule can be easily spread by word of mouth. There is nothing so catchy as a rhyme. For example, when the women in Israel sang, Saul has killed his thousands, but David his 10,000s, it became such a catchy rhyme that it caught on and spread like wildfire, so much so that even the Philistines caught wind of this rhyme and they were singing it, humming it. Years ago, there was an advertisement for a cosmetic, I forget which one it is, Revlon maybe, years and years ago, and this catchy phrase has stuck in my mind. What is that phrase? Pat on a happy face. Which cosmetic was it? Before your time. You see the value of rhyme both in remembering things and in spreading things quickly by word of mouth. So when ridicule has been turned into rhyme, it spreads like wildfire through the community. And Job is saying that I am now become their song. And finally, his lament in verses 16 to 31, I won't read that section, but he is describing the agonies with which he has been grappling, and he does this without explicitly naming God. The fact that he is indirectly blaming God without actually saying so highlights one of the issues with which he has been grappling, and that is, how could a God who has shown himself to be so gracious, loving, kind and protective towards me now, for no reason apparently, turn against me? This heightens the agony that Job has been exposed to. In summary, consider Job's situation at this point in time. All his joy had turned to the deepest of grief. His honor now had been turned into shame. His friends were gone. All those who had hitherto regarded him with the highest reverence now treated him with contempt and shunned him. His health was shattered. He was in constant pain. And as a consequence of disease, his skin had become blackened and had turned unsightly. And all this, unknown to Job, was by the hand of Satan. As mentioned, next Lord's Day, God willing, we shall consider the final defense of Job in chapter 31.